Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Friday, the 14th of December. The Secretary General of the United Nations at the Conference on Climate Change in Bali said earlier, "This is the moral challenge of our generation." Ban Ki-moon went on to say, "Not only are the eyes of the world upon us, more important, succeeding generations depend on us. We cannot rob our children of their future. Our atmosphere can't tell the difference between emissions from an Asian factory, the exhaust from a North American SUV, or deforestation in South America or Africa." We're going to talk about the climate change conference in Bali, which has been going on for some time, two-week meetings, actually, with over 180 countries attending this conference. And there's more than a bit of controversy. The European Union is now saying it will boycott the talks planned by Washington if the United States doesn't compromise in Bali. And there's no sign of a deadlock being broken in negotiations over how the world should fight global warming. How should the world fight global warming, and what kinds of treaties need to be in place? What treaties would be legally binding treaties? And what about the Kyoto Protocol? How many nations on earth signed on to that? Is it meaningless because major powers did not sign on to this? We have much to talk about this hour of our program, and this is an issue, of course, that many of you are concerned about as well. So we welcome you to join the conversation. We'll have two guests with us. Cal Rostiala is with us. Cal Rostiala is director of the Burkle Center for International Relations at UCLA, where he's also a professor in the School of Law and the International Institute. Professor Rostiala writes and teaches in the areas of international law, international relations, with research focusing on international cooperation and conflict in such areas as the environment, trade, armed conflict, dispute resolution, and intellectual property. Later this hour, we'll speak with an assistant professor in the Department of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at Purdue University, who led this very interesting study on quantifying the socio-climatic exposure of different countries to climate change. So this study goes beyond the physical aspects of climate change to look at how all countries on Earth will be affected. 800-486-8655 is our number, 414-227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee. And if you'd like to send an email, you could do that as well. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. Professor Rostiala, hello. Thank you so much for being with us. Hello? Hello, Professor? He is not there, so we'll check on him and get him on the air in just one moment. The second hour of our program today, we saw this article in the New York Times a little while ago about Latin. Those of you who studied Latin and really want to sing its praises will be interested. Those of you who think it's a dead language, why would anybody learn Latin, will also be interested in this author. The author of Carpe Diem, Put a Little Latin in Your Life, Harry Mount, will be joining us. He read classics at Oxford and was a Latin tutor before becoming a journalist. He's been an editorial writer and New York correspondent for the Daily Telegraph, and he has written a book extolling the virtues of Latin and saying that if we learn Latin, we'll know a lot more about our own country, the buildings in our country, the laws of our country, and we will be just much better educated, to tell you the truth. Professor Rostiala, are you there now?
Yes, I am.
There you are. Hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
How enormous is the task? I know it was enormous with Kyoto, and some wonder if it went anywhere, to fashion an international treaty on global warming. I mean, this is a huge issue for the planet, but it just seems to be bogged down in Bali right now. Is it very, very hard? Is this for some reason an issue that makes it hard to put together an international treaty?
Yes, I think it's hard for a whole set of reasons. One of the reasons is it's such a long time period that we're talking about. So when we think about climate change, you know, we can talk about what's happening today. But in fact, most of the problems that really alarm those of us who look at it are problems that will happen in 10 years, 20 years, 50 years, even 100 years out. And we know that politicians are very, very bad at addressing any issue that has a long time period because, you know, their political lifetimes aren't usually very long. So they tend not to be able to think far out. And, you know, I think the public has a hard time thinking that far out. So that's one reason. And there are many others. The costs are distributed all over the world. The costs are very intense, very high potentially, and you know both the cost of action and of inaction.
Mm-hmm.
And the last point is an obvious one, but it involves energy and oil and coal, and you know these are things that are the lifeblood of industrialized societies. And so the climate question is inextricably tied to questions of development in the rest of the world and the way of life that we in the West have long had. So there's no escaping all of these problems, and when you put them all together, I think it's just simply the hardest problem that there is.
What about this fact, though, that this is a huge issue for the planet and involves the survival of the planet? So if ever the United Nations, if ever we were to function as a United Nations planet, this is the issue that we need to take on. We have to take it on, or our grandchildren won't have much of a future. Do people, do the countries on Earth realize how pressing it is, do you think?
Well, I think some do. And, you know, I think some people in the world really, really do appreciate that. And, you know, one sign of change is Ban Ki-moon, the new UN Secretary General, has really made this his issue, his signature issue. And I think that's a sign that more and more, and it's not just Ban Ki-moon, you see people like Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Right, yeah.
Going out and saying, my own governor saying, this is an issue that's really critical, and he's a Republican. So I think more and more political leaders are saying this is something we really need to take command of. In Australia, the Australians have just finally signed the Kyoto Protocol. They had long been in line with the United States, and now they've changed government and changed their position on that. So we do see change, but unfortunately not fast enough. And so that's what's so difficult.
Tell me about the Kyoto Protocol. Has it been of any importance to the world? Has it done anything?
Well, you know, that's a really good question. It's it has and it hasn't. I think what I'll tell you, in terms of what it does, what it purports to do, is it tries to set some targets for action and some timetable, so targets for emissions reductions by mostly the developed countries. And it lays out this timetable, which is going to come to an end in 2012. And this is why we're meeting in Bali, is to talk about where do we go from here after 2012. It really has not done a lot. I think a lot of critics of it would say, look, it's really too little, even if countries were to meet those targets and timetables. It's really too little to solve the problems that we face, that scientists are telling us that we face. And, you know, to make matters worse, very few countries are on track to meet those targets. So even in Europe, Europeans go back and forth about whether they will meet their Kyoto targets. But even if they do meet them, they're meeting them only in a very unusual way, because certain countries like Germany are taking enormous cuts, and other countries like Spain are having enormous increases, and there's a whole story behind that, but they're able to make it work just barely.
Mm-hmm.
And so lots of critics look at this and say, well, you know, really this hasn't done a lot, and we need to be much, much more aggressive. And that's partly what's on the table in Bali right now, trying to be much more aggressive for a time frame that's more like 2020 or 2025.
It would seem to me that the United States simply has to get behind this for any of this to work.
Yes. We're indispensable in the sense that we are the largest emitter, though we may soon be surpassed by China, if not already. It's hard to measure these things precisely. But we are, we're not only central in terms of the amount of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases we put into the atmosphere. We're politically and economically the most important player in the world. So we have to get behind it. And this administration has never taken this issue particularly seriously. Now, it has become a little bit, It changed its tune a bit, and we're seeing changes in Congress. The Lieberman-Warner bill that was introduced in the fall to create an internal U.S. national system for climate change mitigation. The actions of California, the actions of other states who have joined with California to try to take action at the state level. We're seeing those changes in the U.S., and I think they're very promising. But unfortunately, we really need to see it at the level of the president. And, you know, I think the next election will be very critical. If you may have heard that Al Gore was in Bali.
Oh, yes.
and you know, it's been a lot in the news. And, you know, he pointed out this is really important. But at the same time, the election is really important. At the same time, I think we can't be over-optimistic. No president, when Kyoto was first brought up back in the late 90s, the Senate voted 98-0 in a resolution saying that they would not support any climate change treaty that didn't have meaningful commitments for developing countries like China. And so, you know, that's a pretty overwhelming vote. And we don't see those commitments on the table right now in a serious way for developing countries. So I don't want to say that the U.S. is going to turn around and suddenly become a great player in this struggle. I think it's going to take a long time, and Americans are not well primed yet for, I think, what might be coming down the road. And right. It's going to take real leadership, visionary leadership to mm-hmm. do that.
And what about what they're struggling over this week concerning developing countries? This is a difficult issue because obviously the people in developing countries would like to enjoy, I believe, the same standard of living, although we may have gone overboard, as developed nations. So how do you deal with this issue?
Well, it's very hard because they do want that, and it's entirely reasonable to want that. And, you know, when you look at a country like China or India, these two enormous countries, if you think about every person or every family even having a car, you know, it's just unfathomable the amount of carbon emissions that would come from that.
Yes.
Not to mention power plants. China's building something like, you know, one or two coal-fired power plants a week. And so, you know, what we do here in the West is important, but what happens there is just so much more important in the long term or even the medium term.
Mm-hmm.
But they have been very adamant to say, you know, the analogy they use, if I could just take a moment to explain this, is that it's sort of like a, you know, imagine the water's been running in your sink and it's overflowing all over the floor and it's just flowing and flowing and flowing. You know, at a certain point, you come in and say, well, we need to turn that off. Well, it's not just stopping the water from flowing. You've got to clean up what's already spilled out. And the developing countries view the climate a little bit like that and say, well, the rich countries have been just pouring emissions into the climate for a long time, and they need to take really severe action before we begin to do anything, putting aside the fact that they're so much poorer than we are. So they really are hesitant to take serious actions until they see some very aggressive actions by us. And they have not seen that yet. So this is a major stumbling block.
Would you agree then that we're not going to see any kind of meaningful treaty that will have a significant impact on global warming in this world unless the United States has an administration that really gets behind all of this? Or will it be enough to have places like California and in some places in Canada, the Midwest? It's interesting how many cities are kind of stepping up to the plate and have stepped up to the plate in Bali, as a matter of fact. Will that be enough to persuade the rest of the world that at least many of us take this seriously?
I think it's unlikely. I think you need to see really strict federal action. Though, you know, you never know because there are other ways. You know, some people look at this issue and say, well, really what's going to happen? You're never going to get people to change. You're never going to change it with existing technology, no matter what we do. We have cities that are sprawling, like the city I live in, and people need their cars, and they need to heat their homes in Wisconsin. You know, these are things that are not going to change, and we need a major technological change, some kind of silver bullet. Well, you know, maybe such a silver bullet would happen, but that's not a plan that you can plan on. So if you're thinking more conventionally, you have to have action from the top of the United States. That's an essential element in any reasonable approach.
All right, and welcome to phone calls. We have two guests this hour. We're talking about the major conference on global climate change that's taking place in Bali, talking about Al Gore's comments, talking about how to deal with this issue with developing nations and developed nations. Is the United States obstructionist about this? What kind of international treaty can you fashion that will try to cut emissions by a significant amount to actually curb global warming? Are there enforcement mechanisms? We have yet to talk about that with our guests this half hour. Professor Cal Rostiala is director of the Burkle Center for International Relations at UCLA, and he's also a professor in the School of Law and the International Institute. Joining us a little bit later, assistant professor in the Department of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at Purdue University. They've just done a very interesting study on global warming, pretty advanced, and we'll be talking about their findings as well. Here's the number, 800-486-8655. If you are in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now as we talk about the conference in Bali dealing with climate change. And our first caller is David from Ironwood, Michigan. Hi, David.
Yes, I just want to say that biggest thing about global warming is sea temperature. People worry about the water levels rising. But after a certain point, warm water does not hold as much oxygen as cold water, and then you get fish die off, which will lead to a worldwide ecosystem collapse. I mean, that's terrible. I hope that laws in Bali and stuff are pointing this out. I mean, this is the worst-case disaster. If it gets too warm where the oxygen levels drop to a point where the fish die, and the plankton die, this planet's in serious, serious, serious trouble.
Well, I can't agree with you more that the issues in the oceans are absolutely central, and I think that the delegates in Bali, in part because of the what's called the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the group that shared the Nobel Prize with Al Gore, composed of thousands of scientists around the world, they pointed out a whole series of potential and even likely problems like the one you just described. And I think everyone there is well aware of those risks. I think the problem is, of course, what do you do about those risks and how do you avert them? But you're absolutely right to point to the oceans as being central. The Earth is 70% or so water, and so the oceans are at the core.
Mm-hmm. Let's say, and this is, of course, wildly optimistic, that the world really decided to take this on and they went with what might be conservative attempt to change the direction of global climate warming. The EU wants a guidance of cuts of 25% to 40%. Let's say 40% passes in greenhouse gases by 2020 below 1990 levels. Let's say that happens here. How would this be enforced in the world? I mean, how do you do that?
Well, the vision with most of these plans is that you would actually have a system what's sometimes called cap and trade. And we do this within the United mm-hmm. States for a lot of environmental issues. So you set a figure like 40% cut from 1990 levels. So let me just point out we're well above 1990 levels. So it's more than a 40%, much more than a 40% cut from where we are now. And then you say that whatever the particular entity is, the government, perhaps a firm, a power plant, has permits, and those permits can be traded, permits to pollute, in essence. And so in reality, what would end up happening is that certain places where it's very cheap to, or cheaper to cut emissions would end up, being buying these permits, and other places would sell them. And so you'd have this kind of market. And that's the vision of the Kyoto Protocol to some degree. That's the vision of the Lieberman-Warner bill that I mentioned that's been introduced in the Senate. There's other similar bills. Most people who have looked at this problem say that's the only way that you can make drastic cuts or even minimal cuts.
And
so
that's
the sort of idea. Now, how you would really do that in the long run, well, you'd have to change technology again because those numbers are really big. You'd have to think a lot about conservation and changing how we produce power and so forth.
Right. And what makes it cheaper for some to cut emissions than others?
Well, one thing that sometimes makes it cheaper is that let's take a place like China where they're building lots of power plants. Well, if you're going to build a power plant next week or next year, you could build it in a very dirty way or a clean way, and it's often easier to do it clean from the start. That's one issue. Power plants have lifetimes also, so sometimes they're sort of at the end of their natural lifetimes. If you take one that was built last week, well, you know, that's costly to rip it down.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, that's just one example. There are many others, but the costs really do vary. And frankly, countries that have taken more aggressive actions in the past have higher mitigation costs. So a country like Japan, which is very energy efficient compared to the U.S., well, it gets costlier and costlier as you go kind of down the curve. So if you reduce by 50%, that's expensive. But you try to reduce the next 40%, that's extremely expensive. So certain countries are in a tougher boat than others. But when we talk about big numbers like 40%, we're going to need to see dramatic changes in our cars, dramatic changes in the way we heat our homes, electricity. I mean, there's a lot that needs to be done. Those are very, very difficult numbers to meet.
Yeah. Let's go to Mike from Madison. Hi, Mike.
Hi. A couple things quickly. One, I know China needs to build power plants. We're sending them lots of our jobs and lots of our money, and I would think we'd be in a position, as other countries would, to really pressure them to either comply or face sanctions in terms of trade. And the second thing, if I can real quickly, this is an issue that really has potential for our kids and our grandkids to virtually destroy life on this planet the way we know it. Why does it seem to have so little political traction in this country?
That's a good question.
The second question is a great question.
Yeah.
But on the first, you know, we do have some leverage on China, but, you know, remember the Chinese is a very big country with a lot of interest on the part of our companies and our consumers. And they hold enormous amounts of our currency. They have a lot of leverage on us. So I guess I would just say it's a mutual situation there. And I don't think that we can strong-arm China very effectively. And trade sanctions are a dangerous tool, and our government I think rightly has been hesitant to use them in a kind of easy fashion. In terms of why the U.S. public doesn't seem to get behind this issue, you know, I puzzle about that all the time. I don't really understand it, particularly when you look at the fact that gasoline prices have risen so much in recent years. And if you went back a few years ago and you said, let's put $1 or $2 a gallon tax on gasoline, people would say you were crazy, and there was no way the public could support that. But instead, what we've effectively done is given that extra dollar or $2 to Saudi Arabia and Venezuela and so forth. So the politics of this issue are very hard to fathom. But, you know, I think the bottom line is Americans, like a lot of democratic societies, have a hard time dealing with complex issues with long timelines. It's like the Social Security problem.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't really done much on that either.
Yeah. Thanks very much for your call. And then you look at other nations, like oil-producing nations. They would stand to lose a bit of money from all of this, right?
They would. They would. And in fact, the big obstructionist governments in Bali, Saudi Arabia, obviously, Canada, a surprising one, but Canada's now become a major, major energy producer from all sorts of sources, including tar sands up in Alberta. And Canada's very, very unhappy with the direction things are going.
Al Gore saying yesterday the United States is principally responsible for obstructing progress in Bali. Would you agree with that? And would you add other nations to the list? Who would be second, third, fourth?
Well, I think Canada and Saudi Arabia are often singled out. In the past, you might have said Australia, but they have a new government now. I think those are the key ones. But the U.S. is both symbolically, economically, environmentally at the heart of the problem. So I think, you know, Al Gore is probably more likely to criticize the U.S. because he is an American and he's wants to influence what happens here. But I think he's right. We are the most important country in this regard, and we really, you know, we really have to. We don't show action, it's very hard to see how things move forward in an expeditious manner.
Isn't it strange that so much of this becomes politically, depending who's in office, whether or not they consider this an important issue? Obviously, if Al Gore had been president, we would have signed Kyoto, right? I mean, it would have been a whole different ballgame here. If the Australian government had changed hands recently, they still wouldn't be behind this. It seems to be at the whim of politics.
Well, to some degree, that's true. But I, you know, as I said before, I don't want to overstate or give the impression that, you know, if Al Gore had won, we would suddenly be, you know, we have a Democrat in the White House after the next election, things are going to change dramatically for two reasons. One, in our system, the Senate and the House, when it comes to implementing any legislation like this, has to get behind these questions. And, you know, there are a lot of, not just Republicans, but Democrats as well, who are very wary of the costs associated with taking action. You know, but secondarily, it's a hard problem to solve, and it's expensive, and the American public, I think, is not fully ready to incur some of the costs that might be short-term or long-term costs. So I think it's going to take a while, and you're not going to see – in Australia, the political system's different. You can see a little bit more rapid change. It's a little less complicated.
Yeah.
But even there, we don't know what's really going to happen in a few years. It's one thing to sign something. It's another – you mentioned enforcement. It's another to actually comply with.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's some question, too – about whether or not we have very much time on this issue, isn't there?
Well, I think we're probably, I'm sounding a little pessimistic, probably to your listeners, and I think it's probably the case that we are experiencing some warming already, which to some degree is irreversible, and we will experience more of that. I am not incredibly optimistic about where things will go. I think in our lifetimes we will see some changes that are going to be very negative. My hope is that we can stave off some even worse outcomes down the line for our children and our grandchildren. But I think we are going to see some changes. And I think many people would say we're seeing them already. It's just a little hard to discern that. And scientists tend to be very cautious about saying that we're experiencing it now. But you know, many think that we are.
All right. We'll take one more phone call for you, and then we'll just switch guests. Joy from West Bend. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for this important program. I guess I like to look at this as a world disaster and therefore a world opportunity. I'm just wondering if there are any leaders or any scientists thinking and planning in terms of world government and world taxes and world cooperation to solve this problem. It seems to me that you know, with computers and with as much scientific information as we have, we should be able to figure out how to feed the world, you know, make sure everybody's warm enough, make sure everybody makes a living, and kind of even out the wealth so that the environment can also be saved.
Well, in terms of that, you mentioned three things: world government, world taxes, and world cooperation. I think we see the third trying to take place right now in Bali. The first two, not really on the table at the moment. But you started off by mentioning that there's reasons for optimism because there's an opportunity, and I think we do see some people who really view this as an opportunity. And I'll just point to one example in Northern California. I live in Southern California, but in Northern California, in Silicon Valley, climate change has become a big issue for a lot of venture capitalists and other technology-oriented entrepreneurs who look at this and say, we have been able to create the Internet, to create all kinds of incredible technological wizardry, and we can apply our knowledge, our engineering skills, our creativity to this issue and really solve it in a you know, unusual and effective way. Now, whether they can do that, we don't know yet, but there's a lot of brain power being put into thinking about creative ways to solve the problem in a way that would bypass the government kind of morass that we see taking place in Bali right now. So I think there is some reason for hope that there may be some alternative ways to, not that these will necessarily be silver bullets, but there are other ways to think about this as an opportunity. And I think as business people start to think of it as an opportunity, the politics will change. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, we're seeing that already. So I guess I'd like to end on an optimistic note. And my hope is that all of these different forces working together will help us come together and take at least the minimal actions that we need to avert real disaster. Mm-hmm. And I think we can do that.
Yeah, thank you so much for being with us.
Sure, it's my pleasure.
Professor Cal Rostiala, director of the Burkle Center for International Relations at UCLA. He's also a professor in the School of Law and the International Institute, and he writes and teaches in the areas of international law, research focusing on cooperation and conflict in such areas as the environment, trade, armed conflict, dispute resolution, and intellectual property. On the same topic, we are going to continue talking about the climate change talks that are taking place right now in Bali. We're just changing guests here and looking more at the science, new information about climate change. Professor Noah Diefenbaugh is with us, assistant professor in the Department of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at Purdue University. He led a study on quantifying the socio-climatic exposure of different countries to climate change. So the study goes beyond the physical aspects of climate change, such as increased temperatures, sea level rise, and changes in precipitation patterns. And it looks at the interaction of these physical changes with various socioeconomic factors throughout the world. We'll be continuing to welcome phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. If you're with us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Professor Noah Diefenbaugh, thank you very much for being with us.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
Tell me more about this study, quantifying the socio-climatic exposure of different countries. What does that mean?
Well, what we've tried to do is take the state-of-the-art global climate model projections that a very broad group of scientists has been using to project changes in climate over the future, and we've tried to integrate those with measures or indicators of different socioeconomic conditions. And we've tried to do that on a country-by-country basis. So we have quantified the integrated exposure at present based on the current socioeconomic conditions and the projected future climate change, how different nations are at risk to that integrated exposure.
Is there a profound difference, would you say, between how developing nations are at risk and how developed nations are at risk or not?
Well, it certainly depends on which socioeconomic dimensions one is considering. And we certainly see different patterns if we're looking at climate and population versus climate and poverty versus climate and wealth. And that, to some extent, is to be expected given what we know about how those socioeconomic variables vary between nations, but it's not, the patterns are not simply a function of
of the individual variables. How they interact with the variations in climate change is very important.
You talk about, in the study, exposed nations. What does that mean?
Well, we're using exposure to mean how the present socioeconomic conditions interact with the threat or the presence of potential future climate change. We haven't analyzed in an interactive way how future changes in socioeconomic conditions could interact with future changes in climate. So you can think of it as sort of threatened as at present.
Mm-hmm. And have you learned, as a result of doing this study, is there remarkable news that comes from this that the world needs to be informed about, that this is going to happen and we didn't know this was going to happen before we did this study?
Well, I think there are a couple of important pieces of information. One is that just the patterns of potential impact of climate change are a function of both the physical climate change and the socioeconomic conditions, and that the heterogeneity or the variations between nations is very much shaped by those interactions. And that has really important implications for international negotiations of climate policy. Some of the other key findings are that all areas of the world, not every nation, but all areas of the world face sort of maximum or high exposure in at least one dimension. And also that China, India, and the United States, who are currently unbound by the Kyoto Treaty, but are the two most populous nations and the highest emitter nation, that each of them faces higher exposure when we consider the socioeconomic dimensions than if we just look at the physical climate change. They're all moderate climate change nations if you look across the global climate models, but that changes quite a bit when we integrate with the socioeconomics.
What do you think about what's going on in Bali? What do you think of Al Gore's comments yesterday?
Which comments in particular?
That the United States was being obstructionist.
Well, I'm not a political scientist, and I'm not an international negotiator, so I don't think it's my place to comment about that. I mean, I think that certainly our results bear implications for international negotiations, and I think that as we study those implications academically, we certainly see that these sorts of variations between nations and how the threat or potentially benefits of climate change varies between nations, those need to be integrated into a policy framework.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. Professor Noah Diefenbaugh is with us, assistant professor in the Department of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at Purdue University. And we're welcoming phone calls, 800-486-8655, if you're joining us in Milwaukee, 414-227-2050. He led a major study on the socioeconomic effects of global warming. And let's go to John from Madison. Hi, John.
Oh, hi. I've got a question for you. Japan is probably one of the most fuel-efficient nations in the world, and it their economy uses a certain amount of energy, which probably is measured, and it supports a certain number of people. If the rest of the world could adopt mass transit and the fuel efficiencies that are currently present in Japan, about what world population could be supported when we do run out of petroleum in, let's say, 100, 125 years?
That's an interesting question. And frankly, I don't know what that population number would be. Certainly there's an important distinction between the energy intensity of different developed economies, because the energy intensity is certainly not uniform. There's a classic figure of the distribution of nations with the where they fall on the energy intensity scale versus where they fall on the standard of living. And the United States is very far out to the right of that graph where we get very little gain in standard of living for much of our gain in energy consumption, or much of the differential in energy consumption relative to other nations.
Japan moves most of their freight and most of their people move around by rail, which is hundreds of a percent more efficient than moving it around by a truck. They get a lot of bang for their energy.
Mm-hmm. Right. So that's it's well known, like I say, that within the developing economically developed nations, there's a great variety of energy intensity in those economies, and the key question is how. If you're worried about greenhouse gas concentrations, then the key question is by what mechanisms do developing nations end up in one of those energy-efficient pathways if you're trying to limit greenhouse gas increases? So Japan would, as you say, would be a target relative to the U.S.
Yeah.
Certainly.
And isn't the real driver for everything that's going to push countries to be more energy efficient, economics rather than, I mean, there's the global warming issue, and it's noble to talk about it, but the bottom line is, if it's not profitable to reduce global warming for the United States, we will not do it. We do not have the political will to do that. I mean, if you look at 1973 and 1978, we went through a very similar thing. Gas prices doubled and tripled and quadrupled. There was a flurry of introduction of more fuel-efficient cars, a token effort by Congress. But as soon as the OPEC countries realized, my gosh, we responded to that, and world demand did actually stabilize, the price of oil came back down. I mean, even today it's $3 a gallon compared to 78 prices. It's still a bargain.
Except we're looking at something different here. I'm wondering if we have the will, just because we know the enormity of this problem and the impact it will have on this earth, Professor Diefenbaugh. Do we know that now? Can we act just on that? That this is a big deal.
Well, what we know and whether we can act are two different questions. And I you know, from my research, I know a lot more about what we know than how humans behave.
Mm-hmm.
So what we know about climate change is certainly becoming more and more firm every year, and certainly the detection and attribution issue is essentially settled for global mean temperature. So whether or not global mean temperature is changing, there's no question about that. Whether or not it's getting warmer, there's no question about that. And whether or not human activities are the primary cause of that is really not in question either. That's really been settled for the global mean temperature, global
mm-hmm.
warming. What will happen in the future depends largely on human choices and human dimensions that maybe aren't choices, but how population changes, how technology changes, how political will changes, those will all play a very large role in determining future climate change. And in fact, there's more uncertainty in where greenhouse gas concentrations will end up over the next several decades because of those human dimensions than in some ways there is about our understanding of the physical climate.
Oh, that's interesting. More phone calls in a moment. Our guest this half hour is Professor Noah Diefenbaugh, assistant professor in the Department of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at Purdue University, who led a recent study on quantifying the socio-climatic exposure of different countries to climate change. And we'll continue with your phone calls. Thanks very much, John, for your call. If you'd like to send us an email, you could do that as well. It's talk@wpr.org. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, we talk about Latin. Our guest is the author of Carpe Diem, Put a Little Latin in Your Life. All right, let's go back to phone calls. 800-486-8655. Professor Noah Diffenbaugh is assistant professor in the Department of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at Purdue University. We're talking about the climate change conference that has been taking place in Bali with over 180 countries attending, and a bit of controversy on a number of issues, of course, there. Chad is our next caller, and we have lines open now. They've been crowded, 800-486-8655. Chad from Waukesha, hi.
Hello. Everybody talks about if we have the political will. Well, there is another way. Political change is important, but we don't necessarily need the government. We don't have to wait for the politicians. We don't need to wait for the energy companies to come up with solutions. Right now, they're making cars in France that run on compressed air with 50 to 100 square feet of solar panels on your garage. You can charge up your air compressor tank at home while you're at work. And when you come home at night, you can fill your car up with totally clean and free energy. And everybody, you know, talks about political will. All we need to do is get the cars, hop in them, and drive them, and get arrested because they're not going to allow this to come over here, I believe. And the only political will you even need is just get in the car and drive and get arrested.
Professor Diffenbaugh.
Well, I think it's an important point that there is a suite of technologies that exist that are not in the mainstream, and there will continue to be technologies that are developed. And there are people working hard on how do you bring those technologies to market, whether it's through academic study or through philanthropy or other means. People are trying hard to figure out how to best bring these technologies into the marketplace, make them mainstream. And I think that's a key component of any effort to reduce greenhouse gas concentration.
Thanks very much for the call. Daniel from Rice Lake is next. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. Are the socioeconomic consequences of climate change positive anywhere, specifically in Russia?
Well, Russia's a great anecdotal example where, you know, they're planning for an ice-free Arctic and being having that as a key shipping mm-hmm. route and being a key player in that the reorganization of the international trade routes. They're they've laid claim to the North Pole. Certainly, you know, in the climate change projections, there's warming that potentially could improve agriculture in cold-limited areas. So I think that, you know, they're clearly climate change, whether it's due to human activity or just to the chaotic variability in the climate system. In either case, those changes are not uniform. There's certainly, we know there's a lot of variation across space and time and how those changes play out, and the benefits and costs are have been and will be due to complex factors.
Thanks for the call. Scott from Green Bay. Hi.
Good morning. I guess I have two questions and a comment, a question for your guest and a question for you, Kathleen. And this is a subject that confuses me, I guess, to some aspect, frustrates me because I'm not quite sure as to where I stand on the issue in general. And the unfortunate part is when you have a dialogue, a lot of time, if you pose an opposing view, you're considered a global warming denier, like a Holocaust denier, which I find real insulting as the way it's framed. My position always been is the so-called consensus is that this is occurring. And the thing is, when you have consensus, you don't have science. Can't have consensus and science being together. I mean, the consensus 30 years ago was that we were cooling, and that's not science. It's incorrect. More recently, the consensus was after Katrina, we were going to have year after year of Katrinas and multiple ones. And that's not science either, because that's not true. And my questions are to your guest is, what are the chances that this is a natural cyclical event in Earth's history? Because it seems to, and I've read some stuff about it, and that's my point, is why I'm frustrated and confused, because I truly am confused as to what the truth is about this. And that's my question to your
all
guest.
Right. I think he already outlined some of the major findings among scientists, but if you'd like to respond, Professor Diffenbaugh, what are the chances 99% of the world's scientists are wrong?
Sure. Well, I'll answer that question first, and also I have some thoughts on the premise of the question. We know now, and this has really been solidified in the last 12 to 18 months. We know that the odds of the observed warming, the odds of that warming is due to something other than anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions are extremely low. So we can't put the climate system in a lab and manipulate it. It's the global climate system, and we have the one we have. So the complex mathematical models are really our only way to conduct experiments in the climate system. And for global temperature, when we run an experiment without anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions over the industrial period, the warming that's observed does not occur. When we run that same experiment with the anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions, the models capture the what's observed in the data almost perfectly at the global scale. So there's really the only objective interpretation out of that, and there are actually robust statistics associated with it if you want to get into that, is that the warming can't occur or would not have occurred without the anthropogenic greenhouse gas input. So I think that this is, as I was saying earlier, the detection attribution issue for global temperature is really not, it's not an issue, and whether someone calls it a consensus or not, I think is immaterial. It's what we have tested objectively using scientific principles.
But the point is the models also showed Katrina happening year after year. And Kathleen, that you're 99% of all scientists. I'm sorry, that's an erroneous number. That's pulled out of the air.
Scott, wait a minute. Where are you getting your information on all of this? It seems to me as though this is a very large issue, and we need to be specific about what it is we know. And you're talking to a scientist who's involved in global climate change, who understands it.
Here's my point is, and my question to you is you completely agree with it. That's fine. I'm saying I'm confused by the issue. I'm being open about it. What evidence to the contrary have you proven to be incorrect? I mean, because if you look at two sides, I'm just saying I'm being open about the subject, and the model showed Katrina happening year after year, which was totally erroneous.
I don't know where that information is coming from, the models showing Katrina year after year. I mean, in terms of the detection attribution, we did the test that you asked for. We did the objective test. It could have been that the warming occurs without the anthropogenic greenhouse gas contribution, right? I mean, those results aren't doctored. That's an objective test. We did an experiment, and it only occurred one way. I don't know about this Katrina occurring year after year. In fact, statistically, it's after 2005. It was almost impossible statistically to get another year like that in 2006.
You know, I don't mean to get mad at Scott about this, but it seems to me as though from what you're saying, all the scientists we've interviewed on this topic, the conference that's taking place in Bali, this question about whether or not this is happening or not, we do have a consensus that it is happening, and we don't have the luxury anymore of saying, well, you guys could be all wrong, because what are the consequences of that, of thinking that this is still open to a whole lot of debate? I don't think it is.
Well, there's certainly lots of sources of uncertainty about what will happen in the future. I mean, forcing that we're the forcing of the climate system that will occur over the next several decades if concentrations continue to rise as they have been is unprecedented in terms of its magnitude and time period over which it occurs. So, you know, we are working hard to try to understand how the physics will respond.
We have to go at this point. We're out of time. Thanks very much. Scott, thank you very much for your call. Our guest this half hour, Professor Noah Diffenbaugh, Assistant Professor in the Department of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at Purdue University. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda as well for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Thanks for all of your calls, everybody, and for listening. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and then we'll have a fun hour. Those of you who have studied Latin or those of you who think that it's a dead language, what's the point? Please stay tuned. It should be an interesting hour coming up. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.